making TV special.
Venice. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Hi, this is Bob with RealTVFilms.com. We're in Austin, Texas, covering the South by Southwest Film Festival. We've got Doug Benson here. He's in a movie. He's going to tell us a little bit about it. Super High Me.
Yeah. It's called Super High Me, and it's like Super Size Me, but with pot instead of McDonald's.
Nice.
Yeah, I smoked marijuana all day, every day for 30 days, and we got most of it on film and then edited it down into movie length. And people can see it.
Right. Now, tell me a little bit. I know you got your idea from the movie Super Size Me, correct?
Yeah. That's totally where I got the idea to totally rip that thing off and steal that Morgan Spurlock's idea of doing something, you know, that's theoretically bad for you for 30 days.
Right.
But I fared much better than Morgan. I never threw up. And I never had to eat McDonald's.
Well, I mean, you know, people say when they smoke pot, they get hungry. So did you ever head to McDonald's afterwards?
That's true. We did go to McDonald's a couple of times because I have an issue with McDonald's that you can't get McGriddles in the afternoon,
right,
when they would really hit the spot. So we did film me going into a couple of McDonald's and insisting that they give me a McGriddles. And the people at McDonald's are such robots. There was no drama occurred. They just go, no, you can't have it. And I'd be like, come on, give me a McGriddle. No.
Right.
And so it wasn't interesting enough put in the movie. But maybe a DVD extra someday.
Perfect. Now, tell me a little bit about covering yourself on a personal level. I mean, putting it out there, you get high and you do it on a daily basis. How did family and friends accept that? How did, you know, friends?
Whoa, back up. I get high? Where did you hear this?
Well, I'm just curious because, you know, it's like, I try to keep that, I don't talk about it too much. So was that a big deal for you?
Yeah, it was kind of a big step to say, like, oh, I'm going to be in this movie where I'm just high all the time, you know, and before we made it, I was worried that I would do or say something stupid when I was high, but as it turns out, I say and do stupid things, high or not, so might as well take advantage of it and let people be entertained by it, and fortunately it all, you know, worked out okay. I didn't do anything too crazy while I was high, because it's not, you know, I was talking to somebody earlier today about how if you made a movie where a guy just got crazy ass drunk all day every day for 30 days,
right,
first of all, he wouldn't live through the whole 30 days, and secondly, his life would just be ruined. He ruined every aspect of his life, and in this movie we show that, okay, so I don't remember some things and I get kind of hungry,
right,
and that's pretty much as bad as it got. I gained 8 pounds during the 30 days.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, burned it off in 2.5 hours.
Right. Now
that was comedian Doug Benson talking about his new movie Super High Me. And Doug was in town last night here in Portland, Oregon at Barbati's. Went to go check him out. It was great. Saw him, talked to him a little bit afterwards, got a little poster autograph. But I was trying to set him up to do a little bit of an interview for the show, but he did not MySpace me back in a timely fashion. So that did not happen. But anyway, the movie is good. The interesting part and what I wanted to talk to him about was he's got a lot of basically police state footage of the feds raiding, you know, California legal dispensaries. But anyway, if you've never heard Doug Benson, that was just a little quick interview, and even somebody posted up a clip of him at Barbati's last night that's up on YouTube, and there's tons of comedy stuff out there. Been in kind of a comedy mood lately. I've been listening to him and Doug Stanhope and, of course, you know, Hicks and Carlin and Patton Oswalt. But, yeah. So we're going to shift back into the bad news. So, welcome, my friends, to this special homemade edition of Media Monarchy. It's episode 95B, coming to you from my bedroom in downtown Portland, Oregon. And it's October 16th, a little bit after 6 in the evening Pacific time. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Thanks to you guys, always getting in contact, checking out the show, feedback, Yahoo, IM, Skype, YouTube, MySpace, all that shit with Media Monarchy. So make some contact. Now, as we switch, as I said, into more disappointing, disturbing, sad, ugly news that's going on all over the world. And this was something Basically, that's what this whole B-side episode is, are things I wasn't able to fit into last Friday's show. So, here we go. From the Associated Press, NYPD officer kills himself over taser episode. The man was naked, teetering on a building ledge and jabbing at police with an 8-foot-long fluorescent light bulb as a crowd gathered below. Lieutenant Michael Piggott, P-I-G-O-T-T, responded by ordering an officer to fire a stun gun at the man, who froze and plunged headfirst to his death in a scene captured on amateur video and replayed frequently on the internet. The officer was remorseful and distraught. He apologized and sought the family's forgiveness. Then he went to his unit's headquarters on his 46th birthday and fatally shot himself just hours before the family laid the victim to rest. The lieutenant was deeply distraught and extremely remorseful over the death of Iman Morales in Brooklyn. Mayor Michael Bloomberg said, sadly, his death just compounds the tragedy of the loss of Mr. Morales. The suicide marks another tragic turn in a case that has raised questions about the use of tasers by the nation's largest police force. And so, whether it's NYPD or somewhere small town middle America, the cops have been told to go nuts and taser people and they're dropping dead. But remember, it's all a part of that new syndrome that people are having. If we jump now to Raw Replay, again, as we amp up towards October surprise time, who's to say what it shall be? I've always said it would almost be the most and also least surprising is if they would roll out the corpse of Osama bin Laden. So a couple weeks ago on 60 Minutes, CBS News' Scott Pelley talked with a member of the Delta Force who explains the attempts to capture or kill Osama bin Laden, where basically U.S. officials stopped those plans to kill Osama bin Laden.
Delta developed an audacious plan to come at bin Laden from the one direction he would never expect.
We want to come in on the back door.
You were going to come up over the tops of the peaks?
That's right. The original plan that we set up to our higher headquarters, Delta Force wants to come in over the mountain with oxygen, coming from the Pakistan side, over the mountains and come in and get a drop on bin Laden from behind.
Why didn't you do that?
Disapproved at some level above us, whether that was Central Command or all the way up to the President of the United States, I'm not sure.
The next option Delta wanted to employ was to drop hundreds of landmines in the mountain passes that led to Pakistan, bin Laden's escape route.
First guy blows his leg off, everybody else stops. That allows aircraft overhead to find them. They see all these heat sources out there. Okay, there's a big, large group of Al-Qaeda moving south. They can engage that.
Why didn't you do that?
Disapproved.
Why was it not approved?
I have no idea.
How often does Delta come up with a tactical plan that's disapproved by higher headquarters?
In my experience, in my 5 years at Delta, never before.
The military wouldn't tell us who rejected the plans or why. Fury wasn't happy about it, but he pressed on with the only option he had left, a frontal assault on bin Laden's dug-in al-Qaeda fighters. The Delta team had only about 50 men, so the mission would depend on the Afghan militia as guides and muscle. Their leader was a warlord, a self-styled general named Ali.
Ali told us, after about 30 seconds of discussion, he kind of listened to me ramble on, and then first thing he said was, I don't think you guys can handle it. You can't handle Al-Qaeda in these mountains.
Ali, second from the left, met with this CIA officer and accepted millions of dollars in cash from the agency. In short order, his Mujahideen fighters were escorting Delta Force into the mountains.
Paint the picture for me of these Afghan Mujahideen troops.
They range anywhere from maybe 14 up to maybe 80. Various dress. Basically, we would probably consider it rags, which is a standard dress for a Mujahideen warrior.
This is video of the top secret mission never seen by the public before. It was recorded by the Delta Commandos themselves. Dressed like Afghans, the Americans maneuvered up the mountains, calling in airstrikes on Al-Qaeda. By day, they would advance, but at night, they soon discovered that their Afghan allies went home.
Well, I have to assume that if you started up the hills of Tora Bora and the Mujahideen took territory, they didn't abandon that at night.
Oh, yes, they did.
They gave it up to the enemy?
Absolutely. The Mujahideen would go up, get into a skirmish, a firefight, lose a guy or two, maybe kill an Al-Qaeda guy or two, and then they'd leave. It was almost like it was an agreement, an understanding between the two forces fighting each other. Almost put on a good show and then leave.
Phony Al-CIA to bullshit. And you hear it right there. Stopped plans to kill bin Laden. on multiple occasions, even though a lot of military generals say that, no, we did really kill him in Tora Bora in December 2001 in Afghanistan. But it's all, again, I led three lives, black ops bullshit. So even the supposed terrorists don't know who's actually giving them the money. But if we shift gears now to another dead cop story, however, this one's a follow-up from, I believe, earlier in the spring, March 2008. So the original story from March 2008, UK top cop who led CIA rendition probe found dead. So now the follow-up, 6 months later, 7 months later, UK top cop died from exposure on Welsh mountaintop, but suicide is unproven. This from The Guardian. Michael Todd, the former chief constable of Greater Manchester, died from exposure after ingesting alcohol and pills when his personal life unraveled. A coroner ruled at the inquest into his death. The 50-year-old policeman was found dead on Mount Snowdon with an empty bottle at his side March 11th this year. He had sent a series of increasingly desperate text messages in the days before his death, including one asking for forgiveness from family and friends. His last text said, "I'm sorry for what I've done. Forgive me in another life." Todd had visited suicide websites and in the days before he died sent a number of text messages saying he would kill himself, as well as an apology by text to his wife Carolyn for having an affair. However, Dewey Pritchard Jones, the Northwest Wales coroner, said there was not enough evidence to show he had killed himself or had an accident through misadventure. Mr. Todd died of exposure when his state of mind was affected by alcohol, a drug, and confusion due to his personal situation. Basically looks to be suicide. So probably not a big black op cover up there. Nothing to see here. Move along. And moving along to something that, of course, we see, it's not just one country, it's not one state, it's globalist, baby. So we're not the only place that has the combat brigades under NORTHCOM for domestic ops, but they're getting into the act abroad. UK police train for riot scenarios, and Germany deploys troops. So the first one from the BBC. Police officers from forces across the southwest are to receive training to prepare them for riots. Police horses, dogs, and a helicopter will be used to add realism during a two-day course at a Morton and Marsh Fire College, Gloucestershire. Some officers will take on the role of hostile crowds in real-life scenarios such as raves, demonstrations, and disorder at football matches. Missiles and petrol bombs will be thrown as part of the training. Officers attending the training will come from Gloucestershire, Dorset, Wiltshire, Avon, Somerset, Devon, and Cornwall constabularies. Inspector Mac McGarry of Gloucestershire Constabulary Operational Services said, quote, "They're very important and impactive sessions because it's essential all officers allocated to the public disorder unit experience the sort of difficulties they will encounter in real-life situations. It also gives us the chance to test the command structure we have in place and the interoperability with other forces." So, they tell you right there, it's basically essential that all officers, you know, get to experience the sort of difficulties they'll encounter when ATMs aren't doing anything and elections get stolen and food costs a wheelbarrow of something. And it also lets them test their, you know, command and control structures. But if we move over to Deutschland, this from the Associated Press, Germany to allow domestic military deployment. Germany's governing coalition partners want to change the constitution to allow for military deployment within the country if needed to combat, you guessed it, terrorism. The proposal would allow the use of military only if police are overwhelmed and cannot properly respond to a situation themselves. It's not to be used generally, but only in very specific cases, Interior Ministry spokeswoman Danelia Alexandra Pietsch said. The center-left Social Democratic Party, which makes up half of Chancellor Angela Merkel's coalition, had been opposed to the proposal but agreed after working out an agreement that includes strict guidelines for domestic deployment. "We're talking only about emergency help," Social Democrat parliamentary leader Peter Strzok said. For example, the Navy could be called in to help in a situation where police maritime patrols were not sufficient. So the proposal is now going to go to Merkel's cabinet and then to Parliament for approval. Given Germany's militaristic past, many are hesitant to expand the role of soldiers domestically. Currently, the German military can be deployed within the country only in times of war or to help with emergencies or natural disasters. So it sounds like they already have the provisions there and they don't need changed. But it's going to be for terrorism. But what kind of terrorism? Is it going to be fake environmental terrorism? Or how about the financial terrorism that's going on right now? Following the announcement of the new proposal, opposition left party lawmaker Petra Pau accused the government of seeking to violate a constitutionally dictated division between army, police, and secret services. The military has no role domestically for historic, political, legal, and professional reasons, Pau said. That's Petra, P-A-U, Pau. Germany used Tornado fighter jets to secure airspace during last year's Group of Eight summit while troops helped provide support to police controlling demonstrations. So they've already been doing it illegally, but now they're trying to, of course, amend the Constitution to make whatever war crime you did all of a sudden not illegal retroactive immunity. Sound familiar? Merkel's government at the time defended the development as necessary to secure the area and provide technical and logistical support for police, but the opposition Greens Party criticized it as, quote, a creeping breach of the Constitution. So it's happening all over. And again, now what's happening all over is we shift to panic, plunges, and Goldman gangsters. It's been difficult to stay up with every tweak and freak out of the new financial world order, but I try and hit the highs and low points as they may be. So we're getting back a little bit, so some things may have changed, and we'll give you the latest on tomorrow's episode 96. But right now, panic engulfs global stock markets. This from the AFP. World markets suffered massive losses, striking four-year lows as panic-stricken investors doubted whether a Wall Street bailout package would stem the global financial crisis. London, Frankfurt, and Paris all tumbled more than 6%, approaching the halfway mark, while a 15% dive in Moscow forced a halt to Russian trading. We have a seriously weak and fear-driven market at our hands.
Unfortunately, the $700 billion bailout plan has done very little to restore investor confidence. Overnight, global markets have taken a huge hit. London, Paris, Frankfurt all have seen markets down between 3 to 6%. Now, the European markets have been dealing with the government rescue of two of its largest lenders, Belgium's Fortis, as well as Germany's Hypo Real Estate, all experiencing the same type of credit freeze that we are here in the U.S. The Dow is down right now, although investors are watching it very carefully to see whether or not this bailout plan will be able to quickly and successfully unfreeze the credit markets in time to see a real lasting effect on the economy. In New York, Bonnie Ghost, The Associated Press.
And so then there's a report from the AP basically talking about the previous Monday's clusterfuck. Wall Street tumbles below 10,000 amid global sell-off. So, and again, that's going to be a little outdated as I come to you now on the 16th, and this was on the 6th. However, the important thing to point out is, of course, Kashkari, or cash and carry. You give them the cash, they will carry it away. Kashkari to be tapped to head bailout. This from the Associated Press. An official says the administration has decided to pick a key Treasury Department official to be the interim head of its $700 billion rescue effort for financial institutions. The official said that Neil Kashkari, Treasury Assistant Secretary for International Affairs, he's 35 years old, former Goldman Sachs Incorporated banker, the investment giant once headed by Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. Huh. Conflict of... what? Disinterest, perhaps. And we'll get more into the money gangsters. So let's shift gears and kind of stretch out a little bit here. And hit one from the Washington Times. And this goes back to Sunday, October 5th, 2008. Dangerous move for NORAD. Relocating facilities fraught with security risks. And again, my friends, we always like to look at whether it's the labs or the deep underground military bases or what have you. Nestled A half mile inside a hardened rock tunnel, the Cheyenne Mountain Operations Center buzzed with excitement on July 4th, 2006, as the Shuttle Discovery prepared to launch. Then, at approximately 1:30 p.m. during the final countdown at Florida's Kennedy Space Center, the center's alarms and strobes shrieked to life. Defense satellites had picked up a heat-related signature half a world away. An expert crew at the mountain quickly identified it as a missile, pinpointing its type, location, and telemetry. It had been launched from North Korea and was headed east. Several more missile launches were detected, including long-range Taipong 2 capable of striking western United States. As the missiles advanced, the Ops Center alerted top defense officials. President Bush was just a phone call away, and if contacted, might have had only minutes to decide whether to engage America's nuclear arsenal. Fortunately, the missiles fell far from U.S. shores in North Korea, the Sea of Japan, and the Pacific Ocean. Still, the episode marked the end of an era. A few weeks later, Cheyenne Mountain's commander, Brigadier General Roseanne Bailey, retired, and the once highly sought command was downgraded to a quote-unquote directorate. Critics say a decision 2 years ago to move the operations center of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, to the basement of an office building on Peterson Air Force Base in nearby Colorado Springs and to disperse other missions at the mountain could undermine U.S. national security. According to military and defense sources familiar with the missions and U.S. government documents obtained by the Washington Times, the move, billed as a cost-cutting measure, received insufficient government review, violated previous Pentagon directives, may have broken U.S. law, and has left the United States less able to track potential threats and the operations center more vulnerable to attack. Quote, we see decisions like closing Cheyenne Mountain that are driven for cost purposes only, not military requirements, end quote, said retired Air Force Lieutenant General Thomas G. McInerney. Cheyenne Mountain should remain an active facility, but cost pressures are driving combatant commanders to make riskier decisions. The decision to move the Ops Center originated with Admiral Timothy Keating in 2006, head of both NORAD and U.S. Northern Command, created after 9/11 to safeguard further the U.S. homeland. Admiral Keating apparently convinced the nation's top military leaders that moving the center would save taxpayers millions of dollars. And if we click Timothy Keating's name into the HistoryCommons.org complete 9/11 timeline, let's just check out one little quick nugget, shall we? 9 a.m. to 9:37 a.m. September 11, 2001, a top Navy official unconcerned about danger of attack on Pentagon. Admiral Timothy Keating, who is the Navy's Director of Operations in the Pentagon, is back in his fourth floor office for a 9 a.m. meeting with David Newton, the U.S. Ambassador to Yemen. Keating has just returned from the Navy Command Center on the Pentagon's first floor, where he'd received his daily briefing and where he'd seen the television reports of the first crash at the World Trade Center. Despite seeing the second plane hitting the World Trade Center on television, Keating and Newton reportedly do not question their own safety at the Pentagon. Though it's now obvious that the U.S. is under attack, they start discussing the upcoming first anniversary of the terrorist attack on the USS Cole. In 2002, Keating will recall, quote, we were discussing the fact that the Cole attack was coming up on a year's anniversary. Those were almost our exact words at the moment the plane impacted the Pentagon, which happens at 9:37. But in 2006, Keating will give a different account, telling Washington Post Radio that after seeing the second crash on TV, he understands this is an attack. In response, he claims he makes some phone calls and is on his way back to the Navy Command Center when the Pentagon is hit. The command center is mostly destroyed in the attack, and 42 of the 50 people working in it are killed. Thank you, Admiral Timothy Keating, the man behind the decision now to shut down Cheyenne Mountain and move it underground underneath Peterson Air Force Base again, all around Colorado, the New World Airport. But let's keep moving. Let's move into geopolitics, drug wars, radar, and private military. Again, from the Associated Press, drug violence kills at least 49 in Tijuana in 1 week. Police have found 9 more bodies dumped around the Mexican border city of Tijuana, More than 400 people have been killed in drug-related violence in the city across from San Diego, California this year, including at least 49 this week. One week, that week being, of course, the first week in October. Execution-style killings, beheadings, and shootouts have soared across Mexico since the army and federal police intensified their fight against the drug trade nearly 2 years ago. Speaking of the drug trade, on a bigger scale, reports link Karzai's brother to Afghan heroin trade. Again, I'll file this under big fucking surprise. But this is coming from the old gray lady, the New York Times, when Afghan security forces found an enormous cache of heroin hidden beneath concrete blocks in a tractor trailer outside Kandahar in 2004. The local Afghan commander quickly impounded the truck and notified his boss. But before long, the commander, Habibullah Jan, received a telephone call from Ahmed Wali Karzai, the brother of President Hamid Karzai, asking him to release the vehicle and the drugs. This was told by Mr. Jan, J-A-N, that's Habibullah Jan, the commander. He told American investigators, and that's according to notes from the debriefing obtained by the New York Times. He said he complied, after getting a phone call from an aide to President Karzai directing him to release the truck, release the drugs. 2 years later, American and Afghan counter-narcotics forces stopped another attack, this time near Kabul, finding more than 110 pounds of heroin. Soon after the seizure, United States investigators told other American officials that they had discovered links between the drug shipment and a bodyguard believed to be an intermediary for Ahmed Wali Karzai, according to a participant in the briefing. The assertions about the involvement of the president's brother in the incidents were never investigated, according to American and Afghan officials, even though allegations that he has benefited from narcotics trafficking have circulated widely in Afghanistan, with a link to another AFP article for you. So, big surprise, Karzai's brother runs drugs in Afghanistan. But they remember, all do it for God. Gold, oil, drugs. If we move to the International Herald Tribune, Pakistan's frontier turns into a war zone. War has come to Pakistan, not just as terrorist bombings, but as full-scale battles, leaving Pakistanis angry and dismayed as the dead, wounded, and displaced turn up right on their doorstep. An estimated 250,000 people have now fled the gunship helicopters, jets, artillery, and mortar fire of the Pakistani army, and the assaults, intimidation, and rough justice of the Taliban who have dug into Pakistan's tribal areas. But don't worry. The Obama-siah will save us by sending troops into Pakistan. More and more. And more in Afghanistan, too, yeah, because we have to remember, we have to stop some of the illegal drug trade. But if we move to ABC News, private military contractors, they're just not so private. There are others that are far more private and probably a lot more insidious and better at it. Blackwater, they're just, again, as has been said before, they're the Walmart of private military contractors. There's a lot of places that also do similar things, but they're the big happy front face. You know, you could just put the Walmart smiley face instead of the bear claw on the Blackwater logo. It doesn't make a fucking difference. Blackwater machine gun found in raid on Iraqi insurgents. An M4 machine gun sent to Iraq by the Blackwater private security firm somehow disappeared from the company's storage facility in Baghdad and was later discovered during a U.S. military operation, apparently against suspected insurgents, people familiar with the situation have told ABC News. The incident, which happened in 2006, has been kept secret until now, but it raised more questions about Blackwater's operations in Iraq. One last geopolitic bit from Israel Today. U.S. radar in Israel might be trained on Russia. And again, this is from israeltoday.co.il. Time magazine article with a link for you, citing Israeli military officials, suggests a sophisticated long-range American radar system about to be deployed in Israel may be less about providing early warning of an Iranian missile attack and more about hemming in Russia. The radar base will be the first permanent deployment of foreign troops on Israeli soil in the country's short 60-year modern history. Initial reports were that Washington offered the early warning radar to Israel as compensation for not supporting plans to preemptively attack Iran's nuclear facilities. And there's another one that sends you to danger room. U.S. radar in Israel. What's it for, really? But we're going to get back to the gangsters, back to the banksters. Paulson and private contractors to hand out bailout billions. Again, this from Bloomberg, and again, slightly outdated, but just getting it onto the record on MediaMonarchy.com. The U.S. plans to hire 5 to 10 asset management firms as Secretary Hank Paulson establishes the government's new office for handling the financial bailout. A mix of bankers, lawyers, accountants, and others. "We've been doing a lot of work getting ready for this," Paulson told reporters. "I bet you fucking have." Once the legislation is signed, we're going to be going out and lining up advisors from the private sector. Now, there's a little video about how the Goldman gangsters bribed the Senate to pass the bailout bill.
"We started here a week ago with the Paulson plan. It was simple: getting the keys to the Treasury and suspend all the laws.
The administration has come with a proposal that to me reminds me of roulette. And they're challenging us to just take the bullets.
Once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will rally from the hillside, we will gather from the plain."
Madam Speaker, fundamentally there's something wrong with the way we are proceeding. The arguments use fear to build confidence. We're on an artificial deadline, rushing to judgment, and fearful we can't get there in time.
Like the Iraq War and the Patriot Act, this bill is fueled by fear and hinges on haste. So much is missing. There is no requirement that Wall Street pay a dime.
They made an investment. They took a risk. It didn't turn out well.
The AP poll shows 8 in 10 Americans worry the financial crisis will hit them directly. Despite that, 45% are opposed to the government bailout.
$700 billion is a lot of money.
The largest corporate bailout in American history forever changes the relationship between government and the financial sector.
Madam Speaker, the Constitution of the United States is present to protect Main Street.
We have individuals who were drunk. The regulators were the bartenders who continued to pour the drink, didn't stop him from drinking. And now he was drunk, he got on the main thoroughfare and had an accident. The accident clouds the highway.
We're looking at a symptom.
It's the highway we have our pension from.
We're looking at the collapsing of a market that was unstable. It was unstable because of the way it came about.
It's the highway where we have our car loans and our mortgages.
It came about because of a monopoly control of money and credit by the Federal Reserve System, and that is a natural consequence of what happens when a Federal Reserve System creates too much credit.
The entire bill that they voted on today is actually debt.
And it's failed. We go right to your reaction to the vote in the House in Bloomington, Indiana. Good morning. Good afternoon, rather.
Hello, my name is Justin Morrison, and I'm calling from Bloomington, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I oppose this bill along with Ron Paul and all of his other supporters.
And I heard the lady say it again on your show just now, that common Americans don't get it. I heard Feinstein say that last night. I heard your guest say it just now. I heard your two guests in the last couple of days saying the same thing, that we just don't understand.
The people on top have never had it so good. For the first 7 years of Bush's tenure, the wealthiest 400 individuals in our country saw a $670 billion increase in their wealth.
Congress is being dishonest.
My job is not to get things passed in the House. My job is to get things passed in the Senate. I want to take this time to express my appreciation to my counterpart, Senator McConnell.
For my part, I came to the Senate floor and put down a firm marker. If Congress was going to help companies that got us into this mess, then executives at those companies would play by our rules.
This is not a bailout for Wall Street. It's a bailout for our country. You know, the questions that we should ask, does this bill strengthen America? And it does.
The tone that brought us to this
vote this afternoon gets set by the leadership. And if that tone is working in the right direction, a lot of good things can happen.
And that is that we're going to fundamentally change the focus of the economic policy. We're going to focus on the middle class, because it's when the middle class is growing, the economy grows and everybody does well, not just focus on the wealthy.
One of the messages that I have to Congress is get this done. Democrats, Republicans, step up to the plate, get it done.
I put it on hold last week to fight for a rescue plan that puts you and your economic security and your family and working Americans first.
And that pretty much lays it out. Goldman gangsters bribed Senate to pass the bailout bill. And speaking of the consolidation of power, let's now move to the Washington Post. Mukasey Mueller power grab, informants, spies, and lies. So first up, Justice Department officials released new guidelines that empower FBI agents to use intrusive techniques to gather intelligence within the U.S., alarming civil liberties groups and Democratic lawmakers who worry that they invite privacy violations and other abuses. The new roadmap allows investigators to recruit informants, employ physical surveillance, and conduct interviews in which agents disguise their identities in an effort to assess national security threats. FBI agents could pursue each of those steps without any single fact indicating a person has ties to a terrorist organization. Attorney General Michael B. Mukasey, cover-up master of the 93 World Trade Center bombing, said the guidelines are necessary to fulfill the FBI's core mission to predict threats and respond even before an attack takes place. The ground rules will help the Bureau become, quote, a more flexible and adept collector of intelligence, end quote, as independent commissions urged after the strikes of 9/11, Mukasey said in a statement, with a link for you. The guidelines, which harmonize five different roadmaps dating back more than a generation, take effect December 1st. That is 2 months later than initially planned, and authorities said the delay was a concession to privacy advocates and Arab American groups who expressed concern that their members could be subject to racial or ethnic profiling. And I'm sure that's going to be the very fucking least of it. Informants, spies, and lies. So whether it's going to be the IRS that were just handed those similar capabilities to pose and spy and lie. Now we know we're going to head into the green is the new red, and you're going to have little eco cops running around digging through your rubbish bins like they're already doing in the UK. And it's just going to be fucking hell on earth, probably, in some ways. But, my friends, this has been a relatively quick one. We're going to get in and get out because I got to do a bunch of work on episode 96, which we're doing tomorrow morning. So, finally, to end on a slightly silly but always ridiculous and important, to point out the fact that Poppy Bush is wearing a ball cap with the Bohemian Grove owl on it in his MSNBC video with Geraldine Ferraro while they talk about their VP debates back in 84. So, my man Aaron Dykes at Infowars.com and JonesReport.com pointed this out. So, Poppy Bush rocks his Bohemian Grove ball cap during a somewhat gimmicky Today Show interview with George H.W. Bush. The elder 41 reminisced about his debates with Geraldine Ferraro, the only other woman to run for vice president in a major party, who sat alongside him in a discussion about gender roles and discussed the significance of Sarah Palin's VP candidacy in anticipation of the one VP debate. At about 2 minutes and 20 seconds into the interview, the Today Show cuts to another location where the former president is wearing a ball cap displaying the Bohemian Grove owl logo along with his boastful 41 wind jacket. As the screenshot indicates that we got posted up, the owl is distinctly that of the Bohemian Club, as shown in the noted designs. The elder Bush's wearing it during a televised interview should be read as a thumbs up at the democratic will of the people and a reminder that the electoral process is a little more than a sham, thinly concealing the rule by secrecy that really goes on behind the scenes.
And only two people on earth know what Senator Joe Biden and Governor Sarah Palin are really facing in tomorrow night's vice presidential debate. And this morning, we have an exclusive interview with former President George Bush and former Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro, who made history 24 years ago with their own vice presidential debate. Our national correspondent, Jimmy Gangale, asked them to sit down for their first ever side-by-side interview to share their unique perspective and offer some advice this morning. Hey, Jamie, good morning.
Good morning, Ann. Of course, this time it's a man who's a Democrat and a woman who's a Republican, but former President Bush and Congresswoman Ferraro say the pitfalls and hurdles are not so different from what they experienced.
In 1984, Geraldine Ferraro and George Bush made history, the first man and woman to face off in a vice presidential debate.
And if he sees it, somebody sees a silver lining, he finds a big black cloud out there. Whine on, Harvest Moon.
He called the program Voodoo Economics, and it was, and it is.
And each knew the stakes were high.
President Bush, were you nervous about that debate?
Nervous? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
What were you nervous about?
Part of it was everybody said, you're debating the first time a woman has ever run for national office like this. You got to be very careful. And you got to be sure you don't seem overbearing and rude. And, you know, so I was thinking all these terrible things about being overbearing
and rude.
Ferraro, then a three-term congresswoman from New York, had a different challenge.
I had to show that I was serious and that I had sufficient experience not only to be vice president, but if the meat ever rose to president of the United States.
The most memorable moment highlighted both their concerns, this tense exchange on terrorism.
There, but let me help you with the difference, Ms. Ferraro, between Iran and the embassy in Lebanon.
Let me just say, first of all, that I almost resent Vice President Bush your patronizing attitude that you have to teach me about foreign policy.
Well, you got a huge hand, particularly from the press that were back there watching the watching.
Yes.
Really, word of honor.
A lot of women who are in that press.
Yeah, a lot of and so it was a good line, and it was memorable. And so I was saying to myself, I'm not patronizing the woman.
Despite that moment, the two not only respect each other, but have a warm friendship.
Hold on.
Yeah, I'm scaring your mother.
For our interview, Ferraro brought along some of her family to the Bush home in Kennebunkport. And while they still spar over who won their debate, they agree Biden and Palin must avoid certain pitfalls.
She's got to be careful to respond with substance rather than a flip mark. Remember, the only remarks that you took out of that campaign was my coming back saying, you know,
a flip remark.
There you have some presidential puppets and their Bohemian Grove ball caps. So thanks, Poppy Bush. And again, we haven't seen, you know, what am I trying to say? That basically other women have run. And you should check out, and I just watched it recently, Chisholm 72, Unbought and Unbossed. And it's about Shirley Chisholm, C-H-I-S-H-O-L-M, who ran in 1972. And it was quite interesting to look at it. It was basically bad economy, an unpopular war, and a bunch of loser-ass Democrats and Republicans who really don't represent any kind of hope or change or maverickiness. Chisholm 72, so check that out. And that's going to do it for this episode, B-side episode of Media Monarchy 95B. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Thanks for checking these out. I appreciate it. Hit me up, MySpace, YouTube, IM, Skype, and Yahoo. Media Monarchy is your keyword. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active for the love of God, or we're all going to get radioactive. Take care.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
So it's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Same boat on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.